following is a conversation in a series of podcasts discussing topics and issues dealing with high technology crime and digital evidence recovery. These podcasts are presented by SEARCH, the National Consortium for Justice Information and Statistics. This series is made possible through funding from the Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance. Thank you for joining us in a discussion about peer-to-peer legal issues. I'm Elizabeth Tao, a high-tech crime training specialist at SEARCH. Here to share his expertise on this subject is Justin Fitzsimmons, the program manager of the high-tech crime training division at SEARCH. Before we get started, I'd like to have Justin introduce himself.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our podcast. We look forward to talking to you about some of the issues that have popped up in dealing with peer-to-peer investigation. As you just heard from Elizabeth, my name is Justin Fitzsimmons. My background is I was a prosecutor handling high-tech crimes for almost 12 years in Illinois. Following that time frame, dealing with both the investigation and prosecution of high-tech crimes, I had the opportunity to move to a position with the National District Attorneys Association. While I was at the National District Attorneys Association as a senior attorney in the National Center for the Prosecution of Child Abuse, I managed the Technology-Facilitated Child Sexual Exploitation Unit. While I was there, we did trainings across the country for both prosecutors and law enforcement, and certainly the topic of peer-to-peer cases were generally discussed and specifically laws relating to them and case law as well. And then I had the opportunity about 2 years ago to join SEARCH, where I am now as the program manager of our high-tech crime unit. We at SEARCH provide training and technical assistance, and so that is the vast majority of what I do daily now.
A vast majority of court decisions in the undercover peer-to-peer investigations have been favorable to the prosecutions, but not all. There have been a couple of court cases that have gone against law enforcement. In the instances that the court has ruled against law enforcement, what did the court find that was done incorrectly, and how can investigators avoid that mistake in the future?
Sure. What we're talking about when we say courts are ruling against them is at the search and seizure level. In this particular case, the two cases that we're going to discuss, in both of them, the defense filed a motion to suppress the search that was done in order for the police to go into the house and seize the computers and look for evidence of contraband in the peer-to-peer programs and software that was being utilized by the defendants. In both of those cases, there were very specific fact patterns. In one, the first one, which came out of Wyoming, actually they both came out of Wyoming, but in the first one, what ended up happening was the police relied on a software program called PeerSpector. And so they named PeerSpector in their affidavit, but they didn't really describe how PeerSpector worked, and they didn't give very many details on PeerSpector. And so what the defense argument was that basically under a Daubert claim, which is that there has to be some reliability to the underlying software program, that in this particular case, there wasn't any because there were no details included in the search warrant. And so what the court relied on is it said, listen, we don't understand what this program is or what its capabilities are or whether the product that the actual program pulls out is reliable. And so without those details, we're going to rule that there is a lack of probable cause here. And so the court said, in going forward, anyone who uses and relies on PeerSpector without putting in more information about it is going to have that search suppressed. They said in this particular case, under the Leon exception and the good faith exception, they said that they would allow it to stand for that particular investigation and prosecution. And so that case could go forward. But police are on notice that if they're using some type of software to get historical information, then they have to put that information in their warrant. They have to describe what it does and how it works. And so that puts us on notice that in these particular cases, we at least have to describe with some particularity what it is we're using. Now, that does not mean we have to go into every single aspect of it, but there certainly needs to be enough language about what we're using in order to make sure that we establish the probable cause. The second issue dealt with, again, a historical case. And in this one, what had happened was the police were able to look at the particular IP address and GWID of someone who was sharing child pornography. However, they were never able to connect to do a single source download. So since they couldn't connect, but they were able to see historically the hash values of the files that the person was sharing, what the police officer did is they went out and looked at the database of hash values, and where another officer had written in a description about what that particular file was. And so in the search warrant that the officer who wasn't able to actually connect to the suspect's computer did was he put in that he reviewed what the other officer put, and that the other officer's language led him to believe that this was in fact child pornography. But he didn't name the officer. He didn't put any information about the officer in it. And so what the court did is it said, listen, without anything more except simply saying that this other police officer did this and this is what the other police officer found and the other police officer believes it's child pornography, that's not enough to establish probable cause. That would be the equivalent of relying on a confidential informant. And the case law is pretty clear. If we rely on a confidential informant, we have to have more information than just what the confidential informant tells us. We have to have something that corroborates what the confidential informant is saying. So what the court basically said was, here, you need to provide additional information about why what this other officer has done or said is reliable. And so one of the things that we would do is, if we were going to rely on what some other officer did, we would want to actually get the background of that particular officer. What kind of training has that person had? What kind of experience have they had? What were they actually doing? And then get the description specifically of that officer as to what they saw. What would be better is if we actually could get a copy of the picture from someone else's database and look at it so that we could say we actually put eyes on that image. But if we don't have that opportunity, we at least want to say, and we're going to rely on another officer, we need to describe who that officer is, what their background is, why it is that they're credible, and why we can believe what they did, what steps they took in their investigation. And so if we include that additional language, courts would be likely to rely on that and say that, yes, in fact, that does establish probable cause. In this second case, as in the first case, the court again said, listen, just because we're going to say that in this case going forward, you need to do this, we're going to rule that the magistrate in this case would have had a good faith belief that this, in fact, established probable cause. And so, again, they allowed the prosecution to go forward in that case and did not suppress the evidence. But they put us on notice for that any future case, we're going to have to not just rely on sort of saying, well, another officer did this, but actually give some identifiers about the officer and why they're trustworthy.
In peer-to-peer cases, what kind of situation leads to motions to suppress, and are there ways to avoid the pitfalls that lead to these?
Yes, and what we're really talking about here is, and this is probably the most common area that you will see search warrants challenged in peer-to-peer cases, and that's under the Franks decision. And by Franks decision, what we're talking about is the ability of a defendant to claim that the police did one of two things wrong, either their affidavit misstates information, and so basically they're accusing the officer of lying in the affidavit. And then the second one is that the officer omits evidence or information in the affidavit. And that omission of the evidence, obviously in that particular case, that what they're saying is that the evidence that's omitted would go against establishing probable cause. And so by omitting it, what the officer's trying to do is trick the magistrate or the judge who's signing the warrant and not give them the full picture. That if they had the full picture, they wouldn't have signed the warrant in the first place. So there's a couple different ways that this comes into play with peer-to-peer cases. Number one is whether or not we actually have a connection to the defendant's computer, i.e. their GUID or their IP address that's providing and sharing the opportunity of downloading information from that person's shared folder. As a police officer, I am not able to go do a direct download from the person. However, I can tell that based on the hash values that are being shared, we know that this is child pornography. And so I go and I talk about the hash values in my warrant, but I don't mention anything about not actually being able to connect to this defendant. And I just say, I know these hash values are child pornography, or the files behind these hash values are child pornography, without telling the court I never connected to the defendant. That would be an omission of fact. And so the defense would be entitled to potentially have a hearing to suppress that because we didn't tell the judge that we didn't connect. The second one is very similar to the first example. And in the second one, what we're talking about is where we only get a partial download. Now, just because we get a partial download, that doesn't mean that we're not going to get probable cause. First thing we want to do is figure out how much of the download we actually got. So if, let's say, for example, we're downloading a movie and we end up with a, somehow we'll break, and so we get an incomplete file. Is there a possibility that our file, even though while incomplete, still allows us to open part of the file and the part that we actually can open and view? If that, say we have a 5-minute movie and we only get 25 seconds of it, if within that 25 seconds, we still have what would be meet the statutory definition of child pornography or child exploitation, whatever your statute reads, or obscenity, then we're still okay. But we need to be clear in our affidavit to the court. So for example, if we do the partial download, we get 25 seconds of a 5-minute video. We would want to say that in our affidavit. In addition to saying we only got 25 seconds of the 5-minute video, what we would want to say is within that 25 seconds, we see and then use the description of what we see to establish the probable cause that in fact it is child pornography. So we don't just want to make a conclusion to say I saw child pornography. No, we need to define with particularity what it was that made us believe that it was child pornography. So we want to describe the children that we see in the picture. We want to describe the activity or actions that are going on with those children, what sex organs are involved. We want to be very descriptive with our information in the warrant so there's no question later on that we met the statutory definition of child pornography in our particular jurisdiction. And that would be one of the things that we want to weave into that search warrant, is to say the 25 seconds that we saw of this video in fact meets the definition of child pornography as defined by whatever your state statute is. List the state statute by citing reference. So I'll use Illinois, for example. So 720 ILCS 5/11-20.1, and then describe what it is that I saw and how that fits into that statutory definition. Because then there's no question later on going back and looking at this. So that partial download is very, very important for us to disclose. We want to make sure we're disclosing that in the warrant. Same thing with that historical data. So if, for example, we get a partial download and we don't get enough to actually view the file, so say it's a 5-minute video and we only get 1 second of the video before our connection breaks to that defendant, this would be the situation where now we want to say, wait a minute, based on the hash value of that file, we can still say that this is child pornography and he was offering it on this day, but we want to be very clear in our warrant to say our attempts to do a download from this offender were unsuccessful. However, based on what we know historically about this particular file and this particular hash value, we know that this file contains the following. And then again, we go into the description and we do the same thing where we tie it back to our particular state statute. But you want to be very clear in your warrant to say this is exactly what we did and didn't do. And this is what we got and we didn't get. So that there's no question as you're writing this and as the judge who's reading it can say, oh, I see. So there, you weren't able to get it from this guy, but we still know that he had it on this date. And we know that this is child pornography because of this hash value. And this hash value has been seen in other places, and this is what was seen in those other places. And so we describe all of that to the judge, so there's no question about us being accused of omitting facts or misrepresenting the facts that we put in our affidavits.
The defense oftentimes claims that their client was simply using their own computer in their own residence, and their shared folder is private and has a reasonable expectation to the privacy under the Fourth Amendment. How has this argument been viewed by the courts?
This actually is probably the area where the courts have been most favorable to law enforcement in dealing with peer-to-peer cases. There are a series of cases that hold that a defendant has absolutely zero expectation of privacy in what they put in a shared folder. The cases basically come down to the argument, and as I said, there are cases in almost every jurisdiction now supporting this belief, that basically say, listen, if you have information in a peer-to-peer software program, doesn't matter which kind it is, but if you have it in there, and this even includes GigaTribe, there's cases on GigaTribe as well, but it basically comes down and it says, listen, if you're putting stuff in your shared folder, you're basically advertising to the world as if you were a gas station open for business that here's gasoline, all you have to do is pull up and pump. Now, what the courts have said is you're doing the same thing with these peer-to-peer programs. You're saying here's images and movies of child exploitation available for you. All you have to do is come download them. And so the courts say that when it's in the shared folder, you lose any expectation of privacy you have under the Fourth Amendment. Even if you at some point turn your sharing off, if you were sharing it before, you still have given up that expectation of privacy. And even if you try and limit who has access to it. So, for example, in GigaTribe, if we were to go into GigaTribe and instead of making our files available to everyone in the peer-to-peer network on GigaTribe, what we would do is we would say we're going to make a group of 10 people. The court said even if you just do that and you limit it to 10 people, still you waive your expectation of privacy. And so these cases, these lines of cases are very, very good in our favor.
Justin, it's common to see boilerplate language used in search warrants in peer-to-peer investigations. Is relying only on boilerplate language acceptable to establish probable cause?
That's actually a very good question, because oftentimes we will see boilerplate language about sort of the characteristics of people who collect child pornography. And there's a whole series of boilerplate language, and oftentimes police officers will include that type of language in their search warrant. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with boilerplate language. Let me start with that premise. So, for example, when we're talking about child pornography collectors, oftentimes what that language will read is something to the effect of, based on my training and experience, I have learned from some expert that people who download and possess child pornography often are child pornography collectors. And then it will go through a series of factors saying they will keep that this information for a long period of time. They may organize it on their computer so that they have specific types and areas of child pornography and download specific movies based on those preferences. And it will go on about how they hold on to it and what they do with it and the fact that they never get rid of it and they try and hide it from people, which is all really, really good things to talk about. The problem is that when I use boilerplate language by itself, there's nothing that ties that to this particular case. For example, when we talk about the peer-to-peer cases, one of the things that we need to do is we need to say, listen, how does this child pornography collector language apply to this particular person? And what's really great about peer-to-peer cases is that we actually have the ability to demonstrate that this person is a collector. And it's a really simple process. So, for example, if we're doing an undercover investigation, to establish the fact that this person is a collector or a person who does not get rid of child pornography, what we would want to do is we would want to actually check out what they have in their database or what they have in their shared folder on different days. So, for example, if I can say that my defendant X on May 31st has a series of images and files that I know based on their hash value are child pornography. If I go back and I look at the same account 3 days later, or if I go back earlier and look historically and say, let's say that I see that he had those available for sharing on April 20th, I can now, if I put that information in my warrant, so I say, during the course of my undercover investigation, I was able to search the shared folder of this GUID, this IP address, on the following dates: April 20th, May 31st, June 2nd, June 5th. On each and every one of those dates, the defendant had the following files available for download. So I then go through and I put in each of the files that are available. Now, if they've changed, there's nothing wrong with that. We just have to say they've changed. Now, based on the fact that the defendant had either the same files or these different files available within their shared folder on these different days, that leads me to the conclusion that this person is someone who collects child pornography. And that way, we get it out there that, in fact, this person has those characteristics. And so we tie that boilerplate language to this particular case. If we just use the boilerplate language at all, it doesn't really help us. And you'll see court decisions where they say, I find that the boilerplate language doesn't have anything to do with this case because there were no facts that tied the boilerplate language to the actual conduct that we have in this case. So based on that, I find that that whole paragraph of information or three paragraphs of information is irrelevant. But if we can tie it to this particular offender in our investigation, then courts are more than likely going to say this person does exhibit traits of being a collector of child pornography. And so it becomes even better for us as a way to strengthen a search warrant.
Justin, thank you for your time today. In closing, I'd like to get any final thoughts you have regarding the future of legal issues in peer-to-peer cases.
It's interesting because when we talk about digital evidence, we talk about peer-to-peer cases, these cases are constantly evolving. So from a legal landscape perspective, what we see today is definitely going to be evolving as defense attorneys become more familiar with how peer-to-peer networks work and how software that we're using to do our investigations and then become more familiar with it. We're certainly going to see a lot more challenges. We're going to see a lot more requests for discovery. And so the best thing that we can do is try and make as complete of an affidavit application as we can when we're looking for search warrants. Certainly, as we talked about, we want to tie any language that we use that's just broad and boilerplate to the facts that we have in this particular case. We absolutely want to either do one of two things in terms of the images themselves. We either want to describe them with particularity. If we're relying on hash values, we want to make sure that the hash value is in the warrant application and that we go back and we triple check the fact that we have the hash value algorithm correct. If we're relying on hash values and file names, we want to make sure that we include the file name. And as much as I know how difficult this is to go back and look at the images, anyone who's had the misfortune of having to do that knows how awful these are, but we need to explain them in our warrants and we need to put great detail about what it is we're seeing so that there's no question that we have a violation of whatever statutory site we are relying upon in going after our probable cause in these cases. In terms of challenges, I think we're certainly going to see a lot more of them as we get more and more into peer-to-peer cases. Certainly, we've seen a lot more in terms of case law that's coming out. So far, it's mostly been favorable to us. But again, we have to be ever vigilant to make sure that we're conducting our investigations in the best possible way.
Justin, can you provide your contact information so anyone that has questions can contact you?
Absolutely. I can be reached at justin@search.org, or you can certainly call me by phone at 916-392-2550, extension 333.
Thank you for taking the time to join us for this conversation. This project was supported by Cooperative Agreement number 2009-BEBX-K030 with the Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs, Bureau of Justice Assistance. Points of view or opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guest and moderators and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. From all of us here at Search, thank you for listening to this podcast. We hope you will join us again for another edition of Search's High Tech Crime podcast series.